This is Mae Bressel in Carmel, California, and this is tape number 469, November the 30th, 1980. I'm going to talk about certain sections of the book of Charles Higham called The Untold Story, The Life of Errol Flynn. I mentioned it once before, a few weeks back, about the links of Flynn to a doctor who was a member of the Gestapo, Dr. Urban, who got his citizenship in San Francisco as United States citizenship and then went back into Hitler's Gestapo and did spying for Adolf Hitler for the Nazis. And I'm sure today he's still working for the Nazis. He's alive and down in the Philippines. I made the comparison to Joseph Mengele, the Nazi war criminal who joined the Gestapo, came to New York. The other one was in San Francisco, got his United States citizenship, then went on and worked for the Nazis, and that's why he wasn't treated as a war criminal during World War II, because he was an American citizen. Never charged with treason, but he wasn't hurting America. He was exterminating Jews at Auschwitz and experimenting on them, so I guess that doesn't make him a war criminal. Well, there's some episodes. I'll jump around here. Some of the more interesting episodes of Errol Flynn's life. One of the important things was that he owed money to the Internal Revenue. He owed over $900,000 to the Americans. He didn't want to pay taxes, but he kept a neat little sum in a Swiss bank. And we always have to look for missing papers in Swiss bank accounts because the secrecy was set up by the Germans so that they could reestablish themselves all over the world after World War II. He also owned property in Jamaica. He worked with Batista in Cuba, and when Fidel Castro came in, Errol Flynn moved over to Jamaica, and of course Montego Bay in Jamaica is the home of Nazis and British intelligence in the resurgence for World War III down in the Bahamas. He had bank accounts in Switzerland, Spain, and Mallorca, and at the time that he, just before he died, he was living in a home, an estate loaned to him. Higham describes the estate as a loan by millionaire Huntington Hartford in Los Angeles. Well, Huntington Hartford owned real estate down in the Bahamas, in the Key Islands. He had property that he, in turn, sold that became Paradise Island. I called Peter Dale Scott tonight to check out some of the facts on Huntington Hartford and the Bahamas story. And Huntington Hartford's big chain, he's a multimillionaire, was the A&P grocery store, which recently was sold to a German firm, so that a German corporation or group is now controlling the food in the eastern part of the United States. A&P isn't so big out here, but it is in the east. And Hartford loaned his estate, millionaire Huntington Hartford, to Errol Flynn. Errol Flynn died in Vancouver, British Columbia, October 14th, 1959. He was with his girlfriend, Beverly Adland, at the time. They were on the way to the airport, and he had a heart attack, and a man named George Caldo was driving the car, C-A-L-D-O-U-G-H. And George suggests they go to a friend of his, Dr. Grant Gould. And according to Higham's book, Errol Flynn was put in a bedroom and told to lie on the floor. He was having a heart attack, and the doctor, Dr. Gould, and Caldo, the driver, and Beverly were in the living room. They went to the doctor for attention, and the doctor didn't send him to a hospital and didn't even stay with him for resuscitation or whatever he needed. But the three of them sat in the living room and left Flynn alone, and when Beverly went back in the room, he was dead. Now, up to the time that he died, until the autopsy, he was in the apartment with Beverly Adlin and a doctor who wasn't attending him and a driver. And up to the time he died, he had a key that he wore on his neck that was the key to his Swiss safe deposit box, where he had allegedly over $500,000, but goodness knows what else could be in the box with numerous stocks and certificates and bonds. But in this book, he mentions that between the time he died in the doctor's home, where he was taken, and the autopsy, the key was taken from his neck. It disappeared. Somebody right there with Flynn up in Canada took the key to the Swiss savings account, bank account, off his neck. And 3 weeks later, when they got access to this Swiss account through somebody named Justin Golenbach, the box had been emptied. Now, usually when you go to a savings account box, you have to sign a name for entering or leaving. But the reason for so much secrecy in Switzerland is to protect thieves. It isn't to, you don't have to protect honest people if you check into your box and out. So according to Chaim, that mystery was never solved. But I talk almost every week about missing money and missing sources of income for the Nazis. And here is a bank account which did have large amounts of money and goodness knows what other secrets or whatever. And it was completely emptied and nobody ever was charged. I never heard this story until I read this book of Errol Flynn. Another interesting part of this book is after his death, Beverly Adlin, Errol Flynn's girlfriend, flew to Los Angeles, and she was met at the airport by Mrs. Melvin Belli, the attorney's wife. He's had a whole bunch of them. I don't know which order this one was in 1959. And they went off in a car to Mrs. They went into Mrs. Belli's car, and then Beverly Adlin became the temporary ward of Melvin Belli. Now, her mother, Florence Adlin, lived in Los Angeles and met her at the airport. She fought, but was working friendly with her mother. They squabbled back and forth. But Beverly was kept in the custody of the attorney, Melvin Belli. Melvin Belli, I was told, was the attorney for Mussolini. Today, he's the attorney for Mrs. Hermann Göring. He was the attorney for Errol Flynn and the Gestapo members. He was the attorney for Jack Ruby at the time Kennedy was killed, the attorney for the Rolling Stones in Altamont when Meredith was killed and they made the movie Gimme Shelter to put down the anti-war protesters. Belli is close to Noah Dietrich of the Howard Hughes Organization, and Donald McDonald, alias Richard Hughes, wouldn't tell me much about Belli. He said it'll come out in the court in Houston, Texas, but he's going to name him with regards to something of the missing will. He hinted that, but he won't tell me what it was with regards to Belli and Noah Dietrich, but this is going to come up. Hopefully, if he gets a hearing, it's supposed to come up in Houston. And Belli also was the attorney for Charles Wine, and allegedly Navy intelligence, a person recognized as a supplier of drugs for the Manson family, that used the Howard Hughes property at Spahn Ranch, next to the German Krupp Ranch. And, of course, Charles Watson from Texas did all of those killings in the Sharon Tate home and the LaBianca home. So Melvin Belli's name runs through all of this, but I think it's interesting that in the interim when Errol Flynn died and the missing safe deposit key and the emptied box, that his girlfriend was kept as a ward of Melvin Belli. I don't know how long she was, but she was. Another interesting thing that I'm putting together, and I hope you help me with articles or books, is the chronology of Ronald Reagan. It's very important to break down the Errol Flynn story and the Gestapo contacts and the meetings of Errol Flynn with a man, Axel Wenner Gren, the international ammunition supplier, one of the wealthiest men in the entire world, who entertained Errol Flynn down in the Bahamas. This Gren bought Howard Hughes' yacht for $1 million for entertaining. He introduced Errol Flynn to the Canadian Sir Harry Oakes, who was the British Empire's most wealthiest citizen, and Werner Gren was Europe's most wealthy citizen. And Werner Gren had introduced Flynn to the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, and then Flynn had introduced Rudolf Hess and Nazis, Göring and other top Nazis, to the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, and then they went on to meet Adolf Hitler. Now, through the chronology of the Errol Flynn story with Dr. Urban and the Nazis in the Bahamas and so forth, Flynn was working with Ronald Reagan. I did a tape a while back on the chronology of Ronald Reagan. In 1940, he made a movie with Ronald Reagan at Warner Brothers called Santa Fe Trail. Reagan was brought directly from Illinois, where he went to a small college and did some radio broadcasting. He went directly to Warner Studio. And in 1940, he made that movie with Errol Flynn. In 1942, they made a movie together, Desperate Journey. This was with Ronald Reagan at Warner Brothers. And then Errol made the movie They Died With Their Boots On in 1942, the same year, and then went down to Mexico with meetings the heads of the Nazi Gestapo and the Nazi Abwehr and the top Nazi agents in Mexico that left the United States after Pearl Harbor. After the United States was attacked, Errol Flynn was supposed to go in the army. He didn't want to fight the Nazis in any capacity and look for medical excuses, which he was able to find. And similarly, Ronald Reagan never fought the Nazis. He stayed over in Culver City on Washington Boulevard making movies. And Errol Flynn and he made movies through this crucial time period from 1940 to 42. In between the two, Reagan made the movie King's Row. But in Desperate Journey in 1942, from 40 to 42 is when Errol Flynn was thick with Gestapo and Germans and Japanese, particularly German Nazi spies who were refueling U-boats, taking pictures of installations, and so forth. And after these movies, in this time period, Ronald Reagan got active in Hollywood in blacklisting and became politically conservative in Hollywood. And the Warner Brother connection and the links of two movies right in that time period with Reagan don't stand for much by themselves, but when Reagan goes on to become advised and directed by the Hoover Institute in Palo Alto, which was made up of former Nazis, current Nazis, people whose sole ambition is to get rid of Marxism or labor problems or labor organizations and bring in a new order of fascism, the links of those people at Stanford University and the Hoover Institute with George Washington University to Ronald Reagan is too strong to ignore what Errol Flynn was doing at Warner's, and was Ronald Reagan brought in at that time and recruited? How close was he to Errol Flynn? As I say, the very years that Errol Flynn was working with these top Nazi agents, they were in Mexico. They were getting ready for the Axis to win. They had all kinds of information, death to Jew Roosevelt. I remember that time period at Stanford. I went to Stanford from 1940 to 43, those 4 years, and there were signs all over the campus in Palo Alto, death to Jew Roosevelt, or one by a nose, and all kinds of anti-Semitic posters at Stanford University at that time. Errol Flynn was visiting a George Nikolaus of the Nazi Party and a Hans Hellermann, and those were the Gestapo contacts of his friend Dr. Urban's contacts in Barcelona, Spain. While in Mexico, these top Nazi officials were guarded by the Mexican police, the German police, and Mexican generals. And then in this time period, just as he finished his other movie with Reagan, he went down to the Bahamas, to the home of Axel Wennergren, that gentleman I spoke of, described by Haim as the richest man in the world. Now, involved in this can of worms is Daniel Ludwig, the richest man in the United States. Axel Wennergren, the richest man in the world, and Sir Harry Oakes, the richest gentleman of British aristocracy, close friend of the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, who was soon to be murdered. Flynn was floating around with these people in 1942. Duke and Duchess of Windsor moved to the Bahamas right after Pearl Harbor, and in that interim time period when Hitler invaded Poland, and they were moved down to the Bahamas in 1940, actually, and entertained by Sir Harry Oakes. And by 1943, July of 43, Sir Harry Oakes from Canada, a Canadian multi-millionaire who lived in Britain and all over the British Empire, was murdered. That's another story we'll go into. But Axel Wennergren was close to all of these people. He was also the munitions manufacturer from Sweden who supplied Adolf Hitler. He supplied Goering. He supplied Quisling in Norway. Quisling's wife was a czarist, white Russian. And Grin, according to Charles Haim was above international law. He bought a yacht from Howard Hughes for $1 million and introduced Grin, the munitions manufacturer, introduced Errol Flynn to Sir Harry Oakes and the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. Then Flynn introduced the top Nazis to the Windsors, and they all were very cozy. They had a cozy relationship in the Bahamas, and I'm sure many of them have just carried that on continuously. I mentioned back about 3 weeks ago about the background of Errol Flynn and the history of Errol Flynn. And again, I want to remind you that book Power on the Right talks about Errol Flynn, this Major Edgar Bundy from the Church League of America. This group was formed in 1937 by a Frank L. Loesch, L-O-E-S-C-H. Bundy went to a college in Atlanta, Oglethorpe College, then he went up to Wheaton College in Wheaton, Illinois, the home ground of Ronald Reagan, then was a reporter and joined the Air Force in 1941, the same time that Reagan and Errol Flynn were making movies together at Warner Brothers, and then was an intelligence officer during the war, awarded a Bronze Star from the Flying Tigers and Madame Chenault, and worked with the American Legion, the American Sons of the American Revolution, the Air Force Association. And it was this Mr. Bundy from Wheaton, Illinois, who was in the intelligence, working with Chenault, and the same year that Errol Flynn's friend was in and out of Shanghai, Southeast Asia, the Philippines, you name it. And I believe that this man, who he was making a movie in 1968, against the Council, National Council of Churches, and making a movie, Reagan for President Movement. He did a story on Ronald Reagan on the welfare state. I think that this Mr. Bundy should be investigated more. He boosted the apartheid nations in South Africa and Ian Smith and so forth. And the book Danger on the Right suggests that his influence over the churches and promoting Ronald Reagan as president. But this Church League that he has files with 3,000 3x5 cards with people and organizations that have served the communists. And it reminds me of the Mormon data banks in Utah and the caves of political information from the police departments as well as our genealogy. So I think the Wheaton, Illinois connections and the radio station and Ronald Reagan's going right to Warner Brothers at a time where Errol Flynn and many other Nazis in Hollywood were surrounding the studios is important. And I think we'll pursue those chronology of years and study them and see if Reagan was purposely selected back in the early 40s for the role that he's serving today. I know when Reinhard Gehlen wrote his book on intelligence and Hitler's intelligence, he said it was nothing to go back and wait 20 years for a plot to come into effect. If they wanted something, they could plan it for 20 years. Well, I believe that Reagan and the Hoover Institute and this group have planned and worked for a long time, and he's working simultaneously at the time that Flynn is meeting with all these notorious people, and that Reagan should be carrying on where Flynn left off is just not coincidental. The close friend and associate of Errol Flynn was a Dr. Herman Frederick Urban. He has the name H.F. Urban, and if you overlay it, I.G. Farben, it almost looks like Farben. His real name, his Nazi Party membership, was Schwarz, S-C-H-W-A-R-Z, and Errol Flynn refers to him in his autobiography as Schwartz, S-W-A-R-T-Z. But if you think of codes or secret names, and the American files on espionage talk about I.G. Farben, H.F. Urban, it just seems that H.F. Urban sounds so much like Farben, and that, see, was his alias. He was Schwarz in Vienna, in Hitler's Vienna. Errol Flynn mingled with a woman, Gertrude Anderson. The FBI allowed her to escape Los Angeles and go to Mexico after Pearl Harbor. She was working for Nazis, and the FBI allowed George de Morenschild, Lee Harvey Oswald's associate, to get off the hook painting installations down at Corpus Christi during the war, and Freddie McAvoy, the Nazi collaborator during World War II, was refueling U-boats and was very important in the operations for Hitler, and he was one of Errol Flynn's closest buddies. Charles Higham describes in his book, the henchman, the pimp, the fix-up man for Flynn was Johnny Meyer. There's similarities that Johnny Meyer is the M-E-Y-E-R Meyer. There's the M-E-I-R that worked for Howard Hughes organization. Both of them worked for Hughes organization. And the expertise Meyer had was fixing people up, politicians and military generals and admirals and so forth with women to get defense contracts. That's how the Hughes Defense Department really got built up, according to many accounts. Johnny Meyer had a triple career. He worked procuring people for Errol Flynn. He worked for Howard Hughes and was instrumental. And he ends up working for Aristotle Onassis over in Greece at a time where there are allegations that Howard Hughes was kidnapped in 1966 and kept in control over in Greece. The gentleman who is suing for part of the estate of Howard Hughes, who says he was adopted, believes that Howard was kept frozen for many years, that he had ceased to exist for a long time, and that the dehydration he had came from the thawing when they cashed in the body. This is from Richard R. Hughes, known as Donald McDonald, in from Juneau, Alaska, that I met. But the common denominator of Johnny Meyer also, he worked with Roy Cohn and Jackie Onassis, the attorney for the whole can of worms of the Onassis Nazi organized crime connection, also with the Hughes Empire and the henchman for Errol Flynn, who traveled with the biggies. And this was all suppressed until Charles Higham came across these documents. Dr. Urban, the Nazi Gestapo member that got Errol Flynn involved with the Gestapo, is allegedly living in the Philippines, working and studying leprosy. This Donald McDonald, Richard Hughes, his other name, told me his background. He came from Canada, where he worked in the Forestry Service before, Alaska, down in Canada, before it became a state. Then he went on to be chief of security down in the Philippines, just before Marcos came in. And I said, well, what qualifications did you have to become security police in the Philippines coming from Alaska? And he went on and hinted that he worked for the federal government, for, let's say, Daniel Ludwig, for the FBI. And he told how when he changed his name from Donald McDonald to Howard Hughes' son, Richard Hughes, took on that name, that he had to be with J. Edgar Hoover personally because he did espionage work and secret intelligence work for the FBI and the government in the United States. And if he had a passport or another name, they'd have to know that he also was known by that name. So he had these two names and had gone from Alaska down to the Philippines and worked, pardon me, for the various intelligence agencies in the United States. He told me that Robert Mayhew was one of the finest people in the world. Butter wouldn't melt in his mouth. And that Lee Harvey Oswald was a communist. And then, of course, I knew immediately where this man was coming from and how he could spill out propaganda on the one side and then have me believe some of his tall stories on the other. Dr. Urban is a very influential person. He traveled selling his narcotics, peddling narcotics, heroin, and various cocaine and various drugs through Shanghai and through the South Seas and New Guinea, and was apprehended for drug smuggling and confirmed, this book confirmed, along with the woman here from Berlin doing an article on Jonestown, the importance of narcotics traffic in funding the far right, that they use narcotics as a method of funding their armies, or I guess paying off the policemen or buying the autopsy or the weapons, that narcotics traffic is one and the same with the German Nazi Minutemen, the far right wing, and it could be used also, I suppose, for funding broadcasting or the Klan or the arming against the black, the wars at home, and so forth. We talked at length about the narcotics traffic and the Nazis and the resurgence of groups that are funded through the narcotics traffic. Donald McDonald, Richard Hughes, told me that eight people that he knew had been murdered in the quest for the Howard Hughes will, and that those people who took the will could be charged with murder if they were properly investigated. He also told me that at one point they wanted to get rid of him, so they gave him a dose of Aloxin, which is a tasteless substance which causes diabetes, and you go into a diabetic shock, and he was in intensive care and went into a coma. And when you get Aloxin, which has been pretty well worked on, you get the similarity to diabetes, and it can do you in if it's not recognized right away. Well, he told me that this week when we met last Wednesday, and in the same mail from a friend in Minneapolis, I got quotations from a book on Buchenwald called The Medical Block Buchenwald by Walter Poehler. And on page 8283, she sent me information about experiments on diabetes in the Nazi extermination camps and on the records of diabetes and studies of coma cases and the interest of Nazis in diabetes. Our time is up on this tape, so I won't have time to go in that now, but I think it's interesting that on the one hand, this week I was meeting with somebody who told me about getting a dose of Aloxin and trying to be killed by giving him the diabetes and going into a coma, and then getting articles about the experimentation by Dr. Mengele's and the others at Auschwitz and Buchenwald on diabetes. The tape is up, so there isn't time to go more into the Nazi medical experiments and the medical institutes, but Daniel Luck, Ludwig, and Howard Hughes and Rockefeller all have their medical institutes, which I'm sure, if we checked them, would go directly back to the medical experimentations done when Hitler was in power and to the people that he had in the prison camps. My time is up now. Next week, I hope we'll be hooked right back into KLRB. You take care of yourselves as you get ready for these holidays, which come and go too quickly. This is Mae Bressel in Carmel, California, and I'll be back with you next week. Before I sign off, there is one thing I wanted to mention to you. 10 years ago, I couldn't figure out. I didn't feel like sending Christmas presents or Christmas cards, and was really disturbed about Richard Nixon being in power. It was 2 years before the Watergate story broke, but all of this illegal maneuvering was going on in the White House and in the California offices in Sacramento through Governor Ronald Reagan. Counterintelligence and various murders and prison conspiracies and wiretapping and photographing and bugging. And it was really a very depressing time for me just prior to Watergate. And I couldn't figure out what to do for Christmas. So I wrote a 12-page newsletter, which cost me about $1,000. And I had it printed. And it had a message for Richard Nixon and one for Lyndon Johnson, and a message to the blacks and a message to the hippies. And instead of doing the usual gifts and things at the time of the holiday, I mailed this out to every single member of Congress and all the heads of every newspaper, major newspaper in the country, and presidents of the university. And I got out the Who's Who book and looked up the addresses and sent these all over the United States. I think next week or the week after, possibly next week, I will read you sections of what I wrote in 1970. This was my appeal to what I believe were reasonable people to help save us from some of the things that we are going to face in the future, but were obviously being formed in 1970. And I had a basis for my opinions on research up to that point and careful analysis of the many lies and role of the government and the judicial system in the killing of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King. So next week or the week after, I want to share with you what are some of the highlights on that. And for those of you who have been longtime subscribers, I may have a few copies, not for everyone who hears me on the air, but for a few of you to send you copies of that paper that I did send out at that time. So I'll put aside the Reagan cabinet and the transition stage, which is really boring, and tell you where I was 10 years ago and what I think we have to do to be around 10 years from now. So again, goodbye again. This is Mae Bressel, and I'll be back with you next week.